It's going to be more related to the game show trivia, right? So, speakers, under your chair, there is a box. Take a box out, open it up, and put it in front of you. Okay? It's not hard to find. There is five boxes. One. Two. Okay, so open the box up. Oh, wait, one more. Okay? So game show trivia. So in order to keep the conversation fluid, we're going to ask, the audience is going to be invited to ask questions. Okay? Leo, can you please reserve from pressing the buzzer for a minute? And only two of the speakers will answer that question. The first two that press the buzzer. Okay? Now, if no buzzers are pressed in 5 seconds, we're just going to move to the next question. Either the speakers don't have an expertise or they just don't feel like answering the question. That's why they have the buzzer. Okay? Let me demonstrate. Okay, Leo, this question is for you. Okay? Who was the runner-up for 2018 Women's World Cup Soccer Championship? The runner-up, second place, for the final Soccer World Cup.
France won?
Netherlands was the second place, right? 2019 World Cup, right? So, yeah, I was hoping you knew your soccer, but you don't. Okay, so you guys feel comfortable with this? So the first two speakers that ring the buzzer are the ones that get to answer the questions. If you don't feel like you want to answer the questions, don't ring any buzzers. Okay? I'm opening the floor for the audience. Who has the first question? Kelly, please say your name and your affiliation, okay?
My name is Kelly Walters. I'm a PhD student working with Roberto Lopez at Michigan State, and I'm wondering about your current and future perspectives on economic feasibility of controlled environment production.
One more, two? Second one? Okay, Bruce and Leo. Please, go ahead, Bruce.
It's when you peer into the future, it gets dangerous because, as Kevin's pointed out, we got a lot of breeding ahead of us that we can do to do amazing things that are hard to even imagine now. But I don't see how controlled environments are going to proceed to a wide range of vegetables indoor. So I shouldn't say controlled environments, indoor, without any sunlight. I mean, sunlight is, you know, what's the number? Enough, as much sunlight falls on the United States or on the world per hour as the whole world uses in a year. I mean, that's a lot of free sunlight, and that's what we're competing with. That, so I think the economics are going to get better and better. I really liked Rio's talk where he talked about pharmaceuticals. Wow, all that's in front of us. Medical pharmaceuticals. We're going to see that in cannabis, pharmaceutical uses of cannabis, high-value crops. Those are all going to be in controlled environments. But it's going to be limited to really high-value crops.
Okay. Leo?
Well, I fully agree on that. It is for high-value crops or any crop with a higher added value. In my presentation, I said that at this moment, probably the cost price is 2 to 3 times higher of a crop produced in a greenhouse. The difference will get smaller, but it will take a long while, I think, before it's really getting cheaper, and it will still be for a number of crops. In fact, what Bruce already indicated, maybe it gets a little bit wider than he thinks with the number of crops, but it will always be for high-value crops.
Excellent. So we're done with that question. So who wants to ask a question? Please say your name and your affiliation.
Hi, my name is Carla. I'm Technical Service in Hort Americas. And my question is, what do you think about full spectrum? We have a lot of customers now asking for full spectrum and a lot of lamps that are coming out with full spectrum. Do you think that that is the correct direction, or what are your thoughts about that topic?
Okay, only one. I'll comment on it. Okay, Leo, please.
We are learning so much at this moment about what spectrum is best. So at this moment, I think we cannot really answer what is better, just this spectrum or that spectrum. In general, what we see is that monochromatic light is not the best solution. But that we don't, that we, whether we need a full spectrum, well, I see very well growing plants at a limited spectrum. But we're learning every day again about the spectrum, and what we see so far is that most of the research is done with constant conditions. Now you see Kevin is talking about pulsing the light, but then also the next question is, what should be the spectrum throughout the day? What spectrum should be throughout the life cycle? And I think of a life cycle of a plant, I should say. And I expect that for optimal growth, we will change the spectrum throughout its development. So there's not just one spectrum which is the best for one. Even for one plant, it's not just one spectrum.
More than we realize, spectra is driven by technological availability. The LED that has the most biggest advances in the last 10 years has been white LEDs. They're now up there approaching the efficiency of the blues and reds. And we didn't use them not because they weren't good, because they weren't efficient. And now that those are very efficient, we're seeing lots of LED fixtures that are only whites, because they're now very efficient. Then we make up rules about how this color and that color, et cetera, et cetera. But the whites are now very efficient, so we're going to see them a lot more.
Hi, I enjoyed your presentations. Great, actually. Great to see a lot of participants in CEA sector. My question to the panel is, my name is Raj Lada. I'm from Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, Canada. If you are given $1 million to you actually to start up your research program, what kind of area of focus that you will start with, and who do you hire?
Sherry, thank you. You were close. 4 seconds, okay? Go ahead.
Just me?
That's it.
Okay. So if I have $1 million or more dollars, I would definitely focus on more engineering study, making new algorithms or a strategy to control environment, to reduce the energy use and then also resource use, using a good understanding of crop response. Currently, engineers are working, but it's not that, sometimes it's not the direction we want to go. So I want to lead that group of engineers. So obviously, I want to hire engineers in my program.
Hi, my name is Vanessa Campoverde, UFIFAS Extension Agent, and my question is, do you know of any initiatives to transfer this technology to small farmers or rural areas, since we heard it could be very costly at the beginning? Do you know if there's anything going on worldwide?
The only thing I know is that a lot of this is being adopted by other areas like aquaculture and even pharmaceuticals, where they're using animals. I do a lot of extension work helping people advise their light environments for things like axolotls and clams and stuff. So there's aquaponics. So there's a lot that's going on in the space, but it's still in its infancy and not quite ready to be deployable in a horticultural scale.
I'm Sunny Low from USDA. You are all expert from CEA, so that's a question. There are quite a few companies on their website and others also talk about food from the CEA are always safer than the open field. Do you agree, and why?
Always safe.
What did you say, the last phrase?
See, if...
Food produced from the controlled ag is always safer than open field.
Food safety. Food safety between controlled environments and open field. Leo.
It's not by definition always more safe. It depends on how you do it. I think there are opportunities, definitely, for that. But in a controlled, in an indoor farm, you can also do it in a very bad way. If you don't, if you do it in a very bad way, there might be issues with food safety. I think the only things which will be viable in this for a vertical farm, because it is more expensive, you should do it better, you should do it good, and then it is possible, and you, and I think you can create a very high level of food safety, but you have to take action for it. It's not that you just grow it and it's all be there.
One of the biggest aspects of food safety is spoilage. And if you grow it in Arizona or California and ship it to Manhattan, the food becomes less safe in transit. So the fresher the food, as a general rule, the safer it is. So by that standard, indoor ag ought to be more safe, at least for leafy greens.
Joe Mazabni with Texas A&M. There's all this talk about cost of electricity. Is there anybody or any interest or any research done on solar panels and how much is required to run an operation? Is it feasible? Is it doable? Can it? And there's no talk about solution. Always talk about the issue.
No boss or no answer. Okay.
There, I got to make a sound. Yes, there is. Solar panels, economically on the earth, are about 20% efficient. And if LEDs, now LEDs now are up to 80% efficient, blue LEDs. It's remarkable. But you still have 20% efficiency of solar panels. So what that means is you need roughly 4 acres of solar panels for 1 acre of light. Now, if you put those 4 acres of solar panels somewhere in wasted land, that's a good thing, but you can't take up 4 acres of cropland to grow 1 acre of food. It's just the economics of solar panels.
Hi, I'm Laura Reese. I have a question for Dr. Folta. What light intensity were you using when you were doing the pulsed light studies?
Sorry, what was that?
What light intensity were you using?
Yeah, so on most of our work, we've been using 145 micromoles per meter squared per second. I neglected to put that on the slide. I'm sorry. But that's a mixture of red, blue, far red.
Hi, my name is Chung Sok Parks. I'm in the United States with Ricardo as a business scholar from Korea. Actually, I'm helping one company, which is made by the factories in Korea. They have a very hesitating problems. When we survey the running cost of the vertical farms, the most occupied one is the labor cost, I think. So they like to apply this automation systems. Then we don't know how many productivity per day or which size is proper to adapt to automation systems, especially the transplantings. It's very take time by hands. Is there any ideas?
So to reframe the question, in Korea, there is the number one issue with vertical farms is the labor, even though you would suppose there will be less. Do you have any, especially in transplanting and moving the plants around the vertical farm, do you have any information on how can you reduce the labor on vertical farms? Leo.
I think there are already a lot of equipment that's also now being used in the greenhouse industry. I think with a lot of this technology, what also means that you need a large scale of production. What I see at this moment, many startup companies start with a relatively small vertical farm. That's nice, but then the automation is very difficult because then you buy a machine, or sometimes a machine is more difficult to get it working even on a small area, and maybe it's used only a few hours a day, and if you have to use machines to make it economic viable, it should be used much more. So I think also the scale of where you are producing is, it might sometimes limit the automation, and I would say look at the very most advanced systems for greenhouse production, and in particular look also on the type of equipment that has been used for the potted plant. Potted plants in greenhouse. I'm not sure how that is in the States, but at least if I look in the Netherlands, it's highly, well, at least it's quite a bit automated, and a number of them, those type of systems, could also be adapted for vertical farming.
Yeah, I agree with Leo about the availability of transplanting machine already in greenhouse industry. What is lacking is the harvesting machine, because the harvesting is the most intelligent activity for humans, judging which one to remove, which one to take out, and packing, because it's such a perishable product, so it's not easy to automate. So something we need is something to assist people rather than just replacing people. So the sort of collaboration between machine and decision making, assisting people. So that's probably the direction we want to see.
Thank you, Sher. Hi, Amanda Lewis, Texas A&M. You mentioned LED lighting is kind of a breakthrough technology to make controlled environment production a bit more viable. Perhaps related to the previous question, are there any kind of up-and-coming technologies that you foresee also having a large impact on the industry?
Bruce.
Automation.
Yeah, some people say that children are the future, but it's robots. And I think that the technology already exists, to be honest. It's just that it hasn't been applied to agriculture because food is cheap and we have had labor. And I think that now that it starts to become more of a priority, you'll see companies stepping into that space and applying the technology they already have. You can do surgery with a robot. You know, why can't you pick a radish?
And then also the breeding can help automation, right? Making crop more automation friendly.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe to add on that, at Wageningen University, where we will do also for, in particular for the automation for the greenhouse industry, we're working at this moment. I have colleagues working more on the engineering, and they work together with us on the plant side. And I think for a number of harvesting machines, you need to adapt the architecture of the plants to make it more easy for the machines, and that should go hand in hand. So the plant science and the engineering, and it's adapting a little bit the plant and adapting a little bit of the automation.
Thank you. How about the buzzers for a reason? Please use buzzers, okay?
Please. Yeah, Ian Lin from Ohio State. So you can talk about the energy cost of controlled environment, and also it's expensive to breed new plant varieties or engineer them. So, but I really like the idea of combining genetics and controlled environment to create this really high quality crops. How long do you think that would happen? It will take that to happen?
It's going fast, though. I think that it goes as fast as you can get a breeding cycle. And I think as we understand the genetics and gene editing, we can take these things that are already 90% there, and maybe with an edit or two, being able to delete a gene that's inhibiting a light response or something else, and be able to more rapidly adapt them to controlled environments. I think it's be much more faster with editing than it will be with selection and breeding.
Hi, my name is Drew Perkett. I'm a biologist with Corteva Agriscience. And part of my question was already asked by somebody else about breakthrough technology, so I'll reverse that. What do you think is the Achilles heel for controlled environment ag, something we should focus on and try to make sure that doesn't, you know, derail the whole process?
Kevin Ambrose.
It's the economics. If the economics are there, everything will follow. The breeding needs to happen, and I think the economics are going to be there, but it's limited. If this becomes really profitable, wow, we have tons of plant breeders working on it. Arrow Farms told me recently, they're big and they're really well run and do a lot of nice stuff. They said, we're really close to breaking even. And my numbers I presented are their efficiencies for food production are maybe 20% of what I calculated they could get to. So I think economics is a big factor. Is when it becomes economical, wow, and it'll drive all kinds of investment.
Yeah, I kind of saw the problem of the reverse food desert.
that if you start making it feasible to create large amounts of crops in population centers, what happens where crops used to be produced? And I'm not talking about big field crops, but the specialty crops that can be grown affordably inside a box. I think that you run the hazard of not having those available to people in other areas.
Hi, my name is Mitch. I'm a graduate student at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Canada. My question is, with everybody trying to save money on photons and reduce their light input, how is that affecting the flavor profiles of leafy greens and other high-value crops?
There's not just one answer. What we see quite often is more a higher light intensity, often the quality, the flavor often increases. We have seen some specific effects of spectrum, but it seems to be quite, well, let's say species and conditions dependent so far. So I think in the coming years we will learn much more of it. I also get often the question, is the product in the vertical farm, is it more nutritious, is it more tasty than in the field? Also, you cannot give one answer. But I can be sure that I can grow a crop which is much more nutritional, much more better quality, than, or more tasty than in the field. I could also do it the other way around, because we see there is a huge effect of all the different climatic or growth conditions on the different quality components. So I'm very sure that we can do it much better, but we have to make the right choice of all the different growth factors.
If I can also address it, one of the things I think is the problem is we don't eat enough leafy greens, and we don't eat them enough because they're not crunchy enough. They don't have enough turgor. The fresher they are, the more turgor, and they taste better. We just save the world from cancer if we get fresh greens and people want to eat more of them. So some of it is the texture that gets people to eat more leafy greens. More than just the nutrition, just getting them to eat them in the first place.
Kerry Mitchell, Purdue. As you know, one of the biggest current doubts about the indoor ag vertical farming industry is long-term profitability. And a lot of this is stimulated by the very high upfront capital investments required, not just for lights, but for everything, including automation, the degree of automation versus labor, and so on. And recently we've been hearing that some of the largest operations in the U.S. are getting what they're calling grants of $50 million to Bowery, $100 million to AeroFarms, $200 million recently to Plenty. And the thing that bothers me about all this, if they're truly grants, there's no payback. I mean, they're like gifts, and they're giving them money to get past this lack of return on investment. For example, Bruce, the one you just referred to with AeroFarms getting close. So does this mean only the very biggest operations, enterprises that can command grants can actually make it in the industry? What do you think about this?
Bruce. First the buzzer. No, Kerry, that's a great, it's a great thing. It's something I worry about a lot. But when you see the potentials of every one of us talked about this, if we can realize pharmaceutical potentials that Rio talked about, wow, there's a lot to be done there. I see the work, that basic research needs to happen at our great agricultural universities. You know, we need to be doing more background research so they can be profitable. And we're doing that, we're working on it, but we skip over it. Those people giving $100 million, they're not giving it to Purdue, they're giving it to AeroFarms. And they should be giving it to Purdue.
Or any staples.
Yeah. So I think the potential is there. It's just premature to be profitable for these places.
Chris Cutler, Dalhousie University, Canada.
Public trust is a huge issue in the way we produce food and all sorts of different aspects of agriculture. Are there any challenges you see right now in controlled environment or vertical farming as it relates to public trust, or are there any you anticipate in the future?
Chair Kubota.
So one of the things as a foreigner or sort of, you know, grew up in different culture, noticed this controlled environment ag and vertical farm in U.S. is that growers or industries not necessarily advertise the technology way when they sell the produce. Some companies are trying to do that now, but most of them are sort of hiding behind the image of farming, rather than setting that technology and being proud of that technology. So I think we need to have better communication, gaining the trust from the consumers. It's not just telling a lie, not hiding behind the sort of image, but telling the truth, telling the data, telling the, you know, the quality data, safety data, how many cutty-forming units are coming from those produce, and those things are very, very important.
Yeah, I fully agree on that. It's that we should have give a story which is correct. If I look in particular in the European situation, there are consumers who love it. There are also consumers who think this is too artificial, and I think we should have an open debate on that. But it will remain that there will be groups of consumers who don't want it and who want to go for a different product. If I look at, I give many presentations for broad audiences, and up to some years ago, let's phrase it differently. Some years ago, I got quite often people very emotional and very negative about this artificial, as they call it, an artificial way of producing crop. I still get those type of questions, but usually where I got those questions from is relatively from, let's say, people of my age or older. So younger people often look differently also at it, but still, also even young people, there are some people who think it is too artificial, and I think we should be open for that. We should make clear what are the benefits, what is it exactly, and then I think there will be a large community who likes it, but not 100%.
Jacob Schwab, Kansas State University. At least two of you are working directly with genetic modification of crops. How or what can we do to help stem the spread of misinformation, and how are there any good resources to help educate people that GM is not necessarily the end of humanity?
I'll answer that one. The whole thing is that we don't talk about what we do or how we do it. We start with why we do it. And the ultimate job here is sustainability and getting more fresh, healthy fruits and vegetables into the mouths of people worldwide, especially those in the developing world. And when we're talking about new genetic technologies that tend to be looked at unfavorably, it's because we as scientists miscommunicate that. And we have to start with why it's so important for us and our values, and why that's the basis of us having the desire to even try to do it.
Well, this is the conclusion of the discussion. As a token of appreciation, you could take the buzzer with you. And thank you very much. A round of applause for our speakers.